Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Non-compete clauses. They've been an important tool for companies to protect intellectual property and ensure they get treated fairly when employees leave. Well, now the Federal Trade Commission has voted to ban non-compete agreements, presuming it holds up in court, and that's a big if. What could it mean for federal contractors? For some insight, we turn to the president and CEO of the Professional Services Council, David Berteau. Well, David, what is the council? I imagine you're looking at this pretty closely.
We are, Tom, and thanks for having us on here today. The Federal Trade Commission obviously puts its rules out that cover the whole economy, right? So it's a nationwide ban on non-compete clauses. But for government contractors, this has some very unique and I think deleterious consequences. The biggest one is, as you well know, when a contractor bids on a government solicitation, frequently one of the requirements is to name and put resumes in of the key personnel that are going to be performing that work if you win, especially in the services contract arena. Those key personnel actually have a huge effect on the government's evaluation of a contractor's proposal and on the ability to actually win the job and be able to perform the work. Oftentimes, though, the proposal isn't acted on very quickly. As you well know, we've covered on your show a number of times. The government takes a long time to solicit, evaluate, and award contracts. And so the company needs a way of keeping those key personnel relevant for their bid during the process that the government's going through. Non-compete clauses is not the only way to do it, but it's one of the most prominent and one of the most effective ways to do it. So this takes away a very, very important attribute for companies to be able to bid and win contracts. And the government itself will suffer from this.
Right. And so can companies, because someone can just simply take what they know about your bid, about your cost structure, about your technical approach, and boom, they're at the competitor a week later.
You've hit the nail on the head. One of the most important proprietary elements of a company's process is, in fact, how it bids on a contract and on a solicitation from the government. And it's not only your own company's intellectual property, your approach. It might be the work you've done to prepare for this opportunity to help the government, you know, have process improvements as part of that, and the people as well. You take that away from a company. If you make it possible for that guy to go or that person to go to the highest bidder, then you're really going to end up hurting. And the people this hurts the most, Tom, are the smaller companies who don't necessarily have the depth to be able to replace somebody, to be able to protect themselves, through legal action if necessary. And small companies are a big focus of the government. So for this to hurt small businesses, we told the FTC this in our comments submitted more than a year ago now on the proposed rule. The final rule pretty much ignored this process. So you mentioned legal action, and that's certainly something that we at PSC are looking at on behalf of our members.
Right. Would you file directly a lawsuit against it, or would you just file a friend of the court if other, I don't know who might? It will get challenged in court because Lena Khan has lost most of the big ones so far.
It's our understanding that some of our fellow trade associations have already filed lawsuits. And I think those lawsuits, I haven't looked at them personally, but the reports are that those lawsuits are predicated upon whether or not the FTC actually has the statutory authority to do this. I think our basis would be much more on the real impact on government contractors, which not only affects the contractors, it obviously affects the government itself. So the government has a vested interest in this coming out right.
Yes, they seem to favor actions against business, whether there's any effect from what it is they're moving against in the first place.
Absolutely. And we've seen a number of cases. In fact, you and I have talked about a couple of them where the Trade Commission's definition of an antitrust dynamic often is very narrowly focused in terms of what the interpretation is. And we think you need to be broadly focused on changes and the impact on the outcomes and the results.
Especially in markets where prices are falling. We're speaking with David Berteau, President and CEO of the Professional Services Council. And if that wasn't enough, the Labor Department now has mandatory overtime payment rules, and you're worried those could be imposed on contracts without the money being able to be there to cover the contractor increased costs.
We are worried. And this is a similar dynamic, Tom. It's a rule that applies to the entire country, to the national economy, but it has specific, unique, and particular effects on government contractors. The basic proposal here is that regardless of whether an employee is a salaried employee or an hourly wage employee, if they're below a certain threshold, in this case, nearly $60,000 a year in terms of salary, then you would have to pay them overtime, even if they are a manager and they're a salaried employee rather than an hourly wage earner. This has a big impact on government contractors. Why? Because in many cases, the government requires the contractors to bid low-rate employees in order to win the contract. And so you put companies in a bind here. You're going to have to bid lower rates in order to win, but then you're going to actually have to pay more for those employees because you're going to have to be paying them overtime, even if they're technically not covered by the law. This kind of deleterious consequence, again, we raised in our comments on this proposed rule back last November. By and large, it's ignored in the final rule.
It also kind of wrecks a business dynamic for the ambitious that are not expecting to have been hired for hourly work, but they might not be at the top of the scale yet. And so, you know, young people especially, you know, work their tails off to get promoted and to get greater responsibility. And they're not looking at whether they get overtime, but rather whether they get recognition. And eventually the money follows.
Tom, that's a tremendous point. You know, we've been through over the last 4 years since the beginning of COVID, a very different workforce dynamic than we had in the past. As you well know, we've had, you know, more job vacancies than we've had people looking for work. That's been true in the national economy, but it's particularly been true in the government contracting business. And I think that the element of public service, which is a key role that we play, that our members play in supporting the government, is a big driver in attracting the kind of people who care about the mission of the agencies that they support. That's the real driver here. If you end up nickel and diming them, you're going to end up driving people away and make the current workforce dynamic where it's hard to recruit and fill all the jobs even worse.
All right. And one other thing I wanted to ask you about while we have you is a little item in the bill that just passed. It was just signed by the president for Israel and Ukraine aid, and that is the maintenance and sustainment support, which the council found is not defined that clearly, and we're speculating on what that could be all about.
Well, this is a really interesting dynamic, Tom. As you know, it took Congress a long time to engage in and finally pass so the president could sign the supplemental. I think it was originally submitted last fall, so it's been needed for a long time. And if you follow the war, you know that Ukraine has been suffering from lack of equipment and munitions. Much of the attention here, and when you know, the Pentagon announced its package last week, I think it's about $6 billion, it was largely focused on those hardware items, munitions and other military programs and equipment. But buried in there, the secretary mentioned something about maintenance and sustainment support. This is why we think it's important from a PSC perspective. Signing new contracts, negotiating new contracts for more howitzer shells or more air defense systems, et cetera, is going to take a while. It'll take a while to negotiate the contracts. The companies will take a while to build and deliver the equipment. But maintenance and sustainment is something that could be delivered right away. And in fact, you can do it in the country. There is a lot going on now, but typically it's shipped back to the items that need to be repaired or shipped back to other countries, to Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, or even further away, and then have to be shipped back into Ukraine. This is not the kind of thing that supports their needs very well. In addition, Ukraine wants to build up its own domestic capacity and capability. Our view is you can do that a lot better through sustainment kinds of actions where you do the repairs, you do the maintenance, you build up some of the technical capability. You might build up some suppliers for spare parts and components. You get a little bit of the intellectual property, the technical data necessary to repair these things. And you return the items into service a lot faster. So this is not the kind of thing that will take months or even years. This is the kind of thing you can start doing right now. We're really excited about that at PSC.
But it also should be noted, I think, that it would put contractor personnel closer to harm's way.
Well, you've hit the item right smack on the head again, as you say. Obviously, when you have individuals in country, they're at more risk. And this is not a situation unlike, say, Iraq or Afghanistan, where U.S. military forces could provide security. So companies that would engage in this, and there already are a number of them, particularly from our allies, where they've got companies in country doing work on their equipment, repairing it and maintaining it even today. So the companies themselves would have to be responsible for this security. But I think many of our member companies understand this. They're very good at it. They know how to take care of themselves and deliver the results necessary. It'd be much faster, much easier for Ukraine to keep going, and would get equipment back on the line a lot faster.
And by the way, there's a lot more companies from a lot more countries producing major league arms than you might imagine. I'm speaking of taking a walk through the Army show, for example, every fall, you know, in Washington. There are countries who have significant industrial capacity to design, build, and ship major weapon systems, countries that have never fired a shot in anger in 75 years.
Tom, I think you pointed out a competitive aspect of this. You know, if we want our U.S. industrial base to remain competitive, both from a technology point of view and a capability and capacity point of view, then we have to play in the same marketplace, and we can't leave that marketplace vacant from our perspective. In addition, I would note that on the humanitarian side, and there's billions of dollars in this supplemental for humanitarian aid, the U.S. government through the U.S. Agency for International Development and through the State Department has quite a large number of contracts already operating with U.S. contractors and American citizens operating in country today in Ukraine. So it's kind of an artificial distinction between those who are supporting Ukraine from a humanitarian side or a governing side and those who are supporting Ukraine from a military operations and defense side. I think it ought to be the same for both.
David Berteaux is president and CEO of the Professional Services Council. As always, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Tom, and look forward to the next one.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected, and also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important, so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned, or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions, and that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped, and I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with an intentional focus on culture, because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.